Good evening. We seem to be a smaller group today. I mention it because when I started reading this chapter and preparing for it, my expectations were low. I thought, after all, we already spoke for 2.5 hours about the cosmic illusion. I'm fully convinced by his other chapter that the illusion is an illusion. What more is there to say about it? I was wondering. And this chapter is longer than the last one. That is about 30 pages. I think this is 44 pages. What more can he have to say? So I added this subtitle to the talk: The Reunification of Life and Spirit. I discovered about 2/3 of the way through this chapter is not about cosmic illusion at all. This chapter is about Sri Aurobindo. I understood more about Sri Aurobindo and what he's saying from this chapter than on many of the other chapters, maybe. So I was telling Vijay, I'm very thankful that I've been asked to talk here, because otherwise I wouldn't have put so much of effort to understand what he said. I have got a real gift from Mother. King Louis XIV of France was known as the Sun King. He was considered the most powerful, glorious monarch of all of Europe, maybe of all time. He was considered the height of the power and prestige and status and prosperity of the monarchs, the kings. He built the Palace of Versailles outside of Paris, just for his pleasure and enjoyment, this magnificent palace on this huge estate. Now it's a museum and a tourist spot. People come from all over the world to see Versailles. When Mother was a young woman, I think around 21, she was taken to the Palace of Versailles, as so many other people went there on a tour. I don't know why or who took her. And as she was walking through, the place is filled with artwork of all descriptions and portraits of all the kings and queens and famous people and everything. And at one point she stopped. She saw a painting of a young woman on the wall. And she says, "That was me." The name of that young woman was Louise de Valier. And not much is known about her. But it was known that she had a very special relationship with the king, King Louis XIV. And she was a very devout woman. So it's said that Mother and Sri Aurobindo were there at all important moments of history. She was there when the greatest king of all time in Europe was the monarch. There's a novel, several novels written by the French author Alexandre Dumas. He wrote Count of Monte Cristo, Three Musketeers, and there's a sequence of novels. A few days ago, Appa asked me to read an incident from one of those novels. One of his novels is named after Louise de Valier. Of course, it's a story. In that story, Louis XIV is king. He's a young man, maybe he's 20, 22, not more. At the height of his power, he's at Versailles Palace. He has banned dueling in the country. No men are not allowed to fight with one another to settle their quarrels. Dueling was a very popular thing at that time, very common. But he has passed a law, no dueling is to be permitted. He got word one night that one of the dukes, a man named Duke de Guiche, has been very seriously injured. And he had a suspicion whether it could have been a duel. He'll get very angry if he finds out somebody has violated his word. So he calls D'Artagnan, who's his captain of the guard, and asks him to find out what happened. D'Artagnan goes to the place where the Duke was injured. He finds a horse is there dead on the ground. It's nighttime, but he's a very shrewd man. He has the intelligence of Sherlock Holmes. He studies the whole thing for half an hour, and he comes back to the king, and he reports, "Your Majesty, there was a duel. Two men came on horseback." "How do you know there were only two men?" "No, there were only two men because I see the prints in the ground. There were only two horses. And the men came together on horseback. And these are gentlemen of military bearing because I could see that the horses turned the corner together as if they've been used to parading together." Then the two horses split up to opposite sides of the field. One man charged at the other. The other man's horse went off to the side. That man from the side shot the feather off of the hat of the other man. The king is saying, "How can you know all of this? It's like you read the book or something like that." Then that man turned to attack him. The other man shot a second time and shot his horse. Then this man, de Guiche, fell down on the ground and he tried to get up and aim his first shot. By that time, the other man has loaded and shot once more. The shot hit him in the hand, hurt his finger, and the bullet went into his chest. The king says, "It sounds like you were there and you saw the whole thing. How could you possibly tell?" And D'Artagnan explains to him, just like Sherlock Holmes, from all the cues and clues, the blood stains on the ground and everything, how he has reconstructed it. The king says, "You are really a genius." Then he says, "You called De Guiche's close friend named Manicamp, and let us see what he said." He calls Manicamp, and Manicamp says, "I heard that De Guiche has been injured." "Yes, yes, very seriously injured. What happened?" "He was attacked by a wild boar." "Attacked by a wild boar? How could it happen?" "He went hunting." "He went hunting? Who did he go hunting with?" "No, he went hunting all by himself." "Where was he attacked?" "The boar struck him in the chest and in the process broke his finger." The king is really bewildered by this. "Say, you say that he went hunting? You're sure it was hunting?" "Yes, yes, definitely he was hunting." Then the king sent the doctor to examine De Guiche, who's lying on the bed in the house. And the doctor comes back and said, the king asks him, "How is the patient?" "Very serious, very serious." So the boar struck him in the chest? The doctor didn't know what he's talking about. "What boar?" "He went hunting and he was attacked by a boar." One more. He was shot with a bullet. Here's the bullet. I have it. Pulled it out of his chest. It broke his finger and hit him in the chest. The king looks at Manikamp again with very great anger and suspicion and says, what is this? You've been telling me a story. You told me that he's struck by a boar. Now the doctor says that he was shot in a duel with a bullet, which of course the king knew all the time because he knew the story by the D'Artagnan. And Manikamp said, sir, I was only trying to save the life of my friend because I know if you find out he's dueling that he'll be severely punished. So I thought I should sacrifice myself for the safety of my friend. The king says, all right, that's very honorable of you, but you have made me very angry. You have lied to me. I will never pardon you for this. Now tell me why there was a duel. There was a duel over a woman. Suddenly the king got suspicious and he dismissed D'Artagnan and the doctor. And he said, now, Manikamp, tell me what this is all about. One of the other courtiers made a statement about one of the ladies of the court, and De Guiche felt that that statement was an insult to the lady and to the honor of the king. And therefore, he challenged him to a duel. Suddenly, the whole thing changes in complexions. The king is now understanding the duel was really fought on his behalf to prevent rumors and slander and false statements about him. He said, who was that woman? Louise de Valier. So the king said, Manikamp, you have done a good thing. Now I fully forgive you. Then he calls D'Artagnan back. He says, D'Artagnan, I thought you were a clever man. You have completely imagined everything. You have imagined there was a duel. You have imagined that the horse was shot by a bullet. You have imagined even that the Guiche was shot in the chest. Don't you know, it's very clear that there was a boar attacked De Guiche. He was hunting and he's been injured by the boar. D'Artagnan is a very clever man. He says, oh, yes, Your Majesty, now I see my mistake. I was completely foolish. I imagined the duel. Actually, it was a boar accident. And the king said, you be sure to spread the word everywhere about the boar accident, so this rumor of a duel is completely turned aside. So D'Artagnan goes out and talks to everybody about how the Guiche was attacked by a boar. So what is reality? Is reality that the Guiche was attacked by a boar, or he had a duel? Or is the reality that the king's reputation and the reputation of Louise de Valier is more important than the facts? Or is it the reality? Remember, this is only a story. This is not a historical fact. What was the historical fact? We don't know. And was the reality that Louise de Valier was a beautiful young woman whom the king was attracted to? Or was the reality that Louise de Valier was mother, there for a cosmic purpose? So what is reality? This was not just a concern for Shankara or Buddha. This is a concern for us all the time. What is real? When Lizzie reads Darcy's letter, Jane's letter, about the elopement of Lydia. She thinks life is over. Everything is finished. All hope is gone. One minute she was planning to be Mistress of Pemberley. The next minute she's planning to be an unmarried woman for the rest of her life, along with her other sisters in a ruined family. The moment Darcy hears about the elopement, he says, here's an opportunity, I can set things right. For her, she feels completely helpless. At the moment when life was coming to give her the highest fulfillment, instead of fulfillment, life has brought a tragedy and a crisis that's going to ruin her whole life and that of her family. She feels helpless. In the same situation, Darcy says, now I can act. Now I can prove myself. Now I can set things right. I can master this situation and not only remove the crisis or the tragedy, I can convert it into an opportunity. So what is the reality? Is it a tragedy? A unique, unfortunate tragedy which somehow turns out? Or was it all the time the greatest opportunity for Lizzie and for Darcy and for the Bennet family, which not only made her Mistress of Pemberley, but raised the whole family, even Wickham and Lydia and Collins by contagion? So what is really real? One thing is clear, that what we see, the appearances that we see, the superficial way in which life comes to us, certainly is not reality. And there are different views that have been taken by people throughout history trying to understand and explain what reality is. Science has a view of reality. It says, this is real. This is real. The material object which you can touch and see, hold and weigh is real. The ascetics, the rishis who were after the oneness, they said, that is real. That indescribable, inexpressible, intangible, immeasurable, formless one is real. All this? No. This is not it. That is real, not this. The scientist mistakes the forms of the universe for reality. The ascetics of the illusionist tradition came to the opposite conclusion, that only the formless is real, and all these forms are an illusion. All these forms are just a distorting appearance. So who is right? Lizzie saw Wickham and said, any man who is this handsome must be good. And then she found out he's the greatest rogue that she's ever met, and not a word he speaks. Well, actually, that's not true. Any words he spoke were true, but his intention and what he communicated was completely false. So what is this reality? Why do we care about illusionism? Enough of this. We've given up. Shankara was 1,200 years ago, and I don't think there are many followers of Shankara here. Why do we need to worry? Why did Sri Aurobindo write two chapters on this? Two whole chapters, 75, 80 pages. I have a suspicion, but it's only my suspicion. It's not borne out by facts. These two chapters actually were not written along with the original book. The original book was about 970 pages long, written, finished before 1921. 20 years later, he went back and added three more chapters. And two of those chapters were on the cosmic illusion, the one we discussed last time and this one. Why would he go back 20 years later and write about something which he says is itself an illusion and doesn't exist? He's written a book on life divine. Why would he go back and write two more chapters on cosmic illusion? My own conclusion. Be clear, it's only my opinion. It's not, nobody has told me this is. Because 20 years later, after so many disciples have read this book, they have gone back and asked him, but what about the illusion? They have not understood the 970 pages of what he's trying to say. They're still trying to understand this in terms of the tradition. And then even though he has answered that question so clearly in every chapter of the book, still the illusion is more powerful than the reality. I feel the truth of that because when I read this chapter, I understand Sri Aurobindo. It's not Shankara who I want to understand. I'm not worried about the illusionist. But I understood Sri Aurobindo better because he contrasts what he's saying with 1,200 years of illusionism which presided over the Indian psyche. Why is illusionism important for us? Because we're all illusionists. Have you ever felt helpless? Anybody here ever felt a sense of helplessness? That things were out of your control, beyond your control. Things were happening, you didn't know why they were happening, they made no sense, that you couldn't set them right. That it, with the best of your intentions, life has got its own way of doing things which makes no sense. That's illusionism. As long as we don't see the reality, we're capable of that sense of helplessness. Lizzie had that sense of helplessness. Shankara had that sense. Nothing here makes sense. It's only an illusion of Maya. Why is that person talking? I didn't do anything. Why are they giving me trouble? Why are they harassing me? I'm innocent. My intentions are good. I'm an illusionist. This message, this chapter has a deep personal relationship and deep message for all of us because it tells us about our relationship with the world and our relationship with the One. And though he's been telling us in chapter after chapter after chapter, here it comes out freshly and very powerfully with a great inspiration. Think of the characters in the story. Darcy comes to Meryton, attends the dance, looks around and tells Sir William Lucas, every savage can dance. Meaning, he sees everybody in the room is like a savage. He doesn't realize that his behavior of saying every savage can dance is really the behavior of a savage. He lives in an illusion where he sees himself differently and the world differently. Lady Catherine, she feels like she's a monarch, maybe taking after Louis XIV. She feels it's a privilege for everybody to come to her court and sit there and listen politely while she talks any nonsense on any topic. And she assumes that everybody's very pleased, that Darcy loves to come there, that Fitzwilliam loves to come, that it's a pleasure and a privilege for anyone else to come. She definitely lives in an illusion which nobody else shares. Carolyn lives in an illusion of self-importance. Lizzie, when Lydia elopes, lives in an illusion of helplessness, that she's all alone in the world. We know she's not all alone in the world. We know her savior has come at the very moment that the news of the elopement came. We know. She doesn't know. We know the whole thing is settled. The whole thing is done. And Darcy's going to do for her and her family everything they can't do for themselves. But she sees the same situation and feels totally helpless, because she looks at life as an illusion. What she sees is an illusion. When we look at the future, for us, the future doesn't exist. When 15 years ago, Appa said all the devotees should have houses and cars, it's an illusion. It's a dream. It's very nice. It's very interesting. But it's not real. Only when the car is there and the house is there, it's real to us. Today he says every devotee can have 100 crores, must have 100 crores, should have 100 crores, will have 100 crores. It's all very nice. That's nice, but is it true? Is it true? We live in the illusion. For us, what is not here now, what is not tangible, we're like the scientists. If the 100 crores is there, let me see it, let me feel it, let me hold it. And I will believe it. We are illusionists. Ah, please. I would say we are not coming to the real world. We are living in the cinema. We are living in the fantasy. This chapter was written for us to wake up out of the illusionist. You're an illusionist. He's trying to liberate you from illusion, from the philosophy of illusion. You need not be loyal to the tradition of 1,200 years ago. He's come with a new vision and a new message. Accept that and see the reality that that produces. That's his message. A very good point. Thank you. And I wish there are many more comments and questions during this session that will make it meaningful. So what is real? Our body is real to us. Money, especially money in the hand, or money in the bank, not quite as real. Gold around the neck, that's reality for us. Family is real. You know, it used to be a few hundred years ago, people lived in rural areas on farms. They lived on the soil. They lived with a few people. There was no TV, there was no cinema, there was no, even books and newspapers were very rare. Life means it was a small group. We know everybody by name, we know everything by name, everything is physically real. Yes, there's a question. I would like to hear it. Sri Ranjani, please ask.
Good afternoon, sir. I'm just trying to understand from what aspiration and how. So from the story, Mrs. Bennett, being from a middle class family with five daughters, she has this aspiration to get her five daughters married. This is a very good aspiration, and can we say this could be part of illusion, or I'm just trying to understand, Appa's vision of everybody having a house or everybody earning 1 crore is an aspiration. So how would you say that? Would you say that this is part of illusion, or?
It's a very good question. Because this story, see if you agree with me, this story is a story that says aspiration is real. Because this is a story in which aspiration is fulfilled. If aspiration is simply wishful thinking, fantasy, dream, then it won't be fulfilled in the physical plane as the marriage of three girls in a year. How about you? How about all of us? How real are our aspirations to us? Normally, the gold is real. The house is real. The car is real. Aspiration seems to be less real. When you talk about possibilities, the idea, what says 100 crores? That's not real. This is real. Aspiration is nice, but that's not as real as something that's here now. But what does this story say? This story says that aspiration is the source of reality. This story says what you aspire for becomes reality. If it becomes reality, it means it's real. It's more real than the things that are around you because it can change the reality. When Lizzie comes to Pemberley, she sees, I have missed all this I could have been mistress of. Meaning, at that moment she decided, I want to be mistress of Pemberley. Within 5 minutes he comes. So what is the reality? Is the reality I have missed being mistress of Pemberley? Is the reality she has been foolish? Or is the reality that the moment she really decides that she wants to be mistress of Pemberley, he comes to fulfill that? So what does it tell us? It tells us something fundamental that the scientist doesn't believe. Our aspirations determine the reality. The inner determines the outer. So this is one of the fundamental issues for us. Is the outer thing, I say, so I want to get a promotion, or I want a good marriage for my children or something, but there's always a but. I didn't pass the exams. I don't have enough money for dowry. There's some problem with our family. So many things are there which prevent the fulfillment. All those material things are the obstacles for our fulfillment. So what is real? Are the material conditions the reality, or are our inner aspirations and determinations the reality? This is what this chapter is all about. And the story is powerful because it says that the inner aspiration is the determinant, is the creator. it's not Mrs. Bennett's outer acts that lead to the fulfillment in the story. Everything she does outwardly spoils the things for the family. It's her inner aspiration. So we must understand the inner aspiration is really powerful. So there are different ways. Have I answered your question, Shiranjan?
Yes, sir. Thanks a lot.
Ask more and I will thank you. Yes, the center is the example for that. The aspiration has materialized. This is the process of creation. Now, if you talk to the illusionist, they'll say, center is not real. Yes. So can we believe at this moment, can you believe, all of you, at this moment, that your aspiration is more powerful than any material circumstance? That there is no material circumstance, no law, nothing, age, health, caste, community, anything that can determine if you realize where the power is? This is a chapter about power. This is a chapter about what determines reality. And he says, yes, yes. It's the best possible example. It's a real example. So, come back to the question, how do we know what is real? Well, there are different approaches. According to the scientists, the objects which we perceive are real. Material things are real. In fact, according to the scientists, only material things are real. The scientist goes so far as to say our brain, our mind is only a computer. Our feelings, our emotions, and our sensations are only chemicals and electrical events. They're purely material. Science, it comes out very beautifully in this chapter. Everything is only a product of energy, electrons, molecules, cells, chemicals. The scientist is a great illusionist because he believes only in that everything is material and everything has come out of this material base. Only the material is real. You compare the scientist with the illusionist. The illusionist says only Brahman is real. The world is not real. The individual is not real. And the act of perception our experience, our consciousness of the world is not real. The only thing that's real is the formless one. You see the similarity? The scientist says the only thing that's real is material. It's not just the divine that the scientist is denying. He denies his own personality. Because if really we are only a bunch of chemicals and electrical impulses, how can you have a personality? How can I be talking about I want this and I want that? Where does the sense of individuality come from? Where does the sense of identity come from? My feelings are like that. What? You. How do you have any feelings? There are no feelings. There's only chemistry going on here. The scientist denies his own experience of emotions, his own experience of thoughts. He's come up with a theory that is contradicted by his own feelings. When he sees his children, he feels very happy. Then he has to remind himself, oh, I'm not happy. Some chemicals are going on here. When he thinks I've got a great idea, he has to remind himself, which he never does, there's no you. Who is the I? There's no I there. There's no idea. There's nothing called an idea. There's only chemistry and electricity. He lives in a world which is completely different than his conception. And he lives with this dichotomy, this contradiction, that he has a theory about the world which doesn't match his own experience. Well, that's what happens with the illusionist too. The illusionist accepted a theory that the world doesn't exist, that he doesn't exist, that things in the world don't exist. Yet every day he goes, if he walks and he hits his foot along the stone, it hurts. If a dog bites him, he bleeds. He has an idea in his head that's opposite to actually his experience. And yet he's so faithful to his idea that he tells himself, I know that this really doesn't hurt. There's no toe that's broken. There's no arm that's been bitten. There's no pain. There's no blood. It's only an illusion. I only have to wake up from it and quickly get back to the one. This is what human beings do. It sounds, as I said in the beginning, I was never interested in illusionism because who could possibly take seriously the fact that the world didn't exist? But I have grown up with science. And the more I think about science and what the scientist says is equally fantastic. Because he's convinced he doesn't exist. That his emotions don't exist, that his ideas that don't exist. We've been talking about Mr. Bennett. He has the value of honor. Mrs. Bennett has the power of aspiration. According to the scientists, there's nothing called aspiration. Aspiration is not a chemical, it's not a molecule, it's not an electrical event. It doesn't exist. So this capacity for human beings to believe something that's diametrically opposite to their own experience is quite fascinating. It tells us not that somebody is very foolish. It's not that the scientist is a fool. And certainly Shankara, whatever Shankara was, he was not a fool. Sri Aurobindo says there's never been a greater intellect on earth than Shankara. And there's never been a more powerful personality on earth than Buddha. It's not any individual that has made a mistake. We have to understand that illusionism comes because of the nature of the mind. The illusion is not the mistake of a person. The illusion comes because we're using an instrument called mind to try to understand reality. And mind is an instrument of ignorance, not an instrument of truth, not an instrument of reality. Vijaya told me that on May 1st, There's the class on Life Divine on the chapter of Conscious Force. The whole question that Sri Aurobindo's trying to answer is, what is the relationship between the Divine One and the world? The world is the product of force. The world is created by force. What is the relationship between them? Unfortunately, the old illusionists are not the only ones who are confused on this issue. Because most of us, if we consult our views and think about it, if you talk about spirit, where is spirit? Up there. What is spirit? It's a formless, infinite, eternal, intangible, indescribable. I don't really know what it is, but it's not like this. The whole fact that we live in a world in which we think spirit is somewhere else is an illusion. And that is the illusion that he's trying to dissolve, to destroy in this chapter. Spirit is not that. It is that. It is not just that. Spirit is this. And no matter how many times we read it, no matter how many times it's said, the next time somebody mentions mother, pray to mother, she seems to be very far away. Call for the divine, divine doesn't hear what I say. Why has he abandoned me? Which means that the divine is different than you are, right? Which means the divine lives in some other world where everything's all right. We are all illusionists. The key secret for us is, what is the relationship between what is real and what is the forms we see in the universe? Satchitananda is the formula of the Upanishads. Sat means existence. Existence is reality. Existence is what is true. Conscious force is how that existence manifests itself. What is the relationship between them? In the illusionist philosophy, Brahman is the existence. Maya is the conscious force. But according to the illusionist philosophy, Maya is not existing. Maya is not real. There's only reality is the formless Brahman. So Sri Aurobindo's writing to try to reconnect the spirit and the world, spirit and life, our inner reality and the outer reality. That everything that happens outside is really the result of what's happening inside. Only then we have the knowledge of Sri Aurobindo. Only when we know divine is not there. Mother is not somewhere else. Mother is here. Divine is here. Transcendent is here. One is here. Sri Aurobindo's trying to pick up the pieces and put them back together. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall, had a great fall, broke into so many pieces, and nobody was able to put it back together again. Sri Aurobindo's trying to put back together reality. Reality is three things. It is the pure being, the one, the infinite eternal one. It expresses itself through forms and forces and consciousness. It becomes and materializes as the world around us. They are not three realities. They are one reality. And as long as we don't see that, we are living in an illusion. And therefore, 44 pages is not a lot for trying to wake us up. We've already read 250 pages or 350 pages. Another 44 pages, it's worth reading to try to come out of this illusion. What do you believe is really real? Is it the chain around the neck? Or is it love? Which is more real? Is love more real, or is the chain? Is it truth? Or is it a house? Is it grace? Or is it a marriage ceremony? Which is more real to us? If you give the answer to yourself, which I think we honestly would give to ourselves, then at least we know. No sense blaming the illusionist. No sense blaming the scientist. We are exactly like them. We make the same mistake they make. And when Lizzie's feeling the most helpless, she has the most power. When she's at the height of her crisis, she's faced with the greatest opportunity of her life, but she doesn't see it because she's living in an illusion. I had an experience, maybe I narrated it once because it made a big impact on me. I went to meet a very famous Indian scientist, a biologist and physicist, who founded a very famous institute in India. And I was trying to ask him about the latest developments in biology, and he said, we really have answered all the questions now. We are just a half an inch from the ultimate truth. We know that life is a product of the chemistry and the electrical things. We know how it came. We've really got all the answers. Then he changed the subject and started talking to me about this famous institution which he created about 30 years ago. And he shook his head and he said, things have gotten very bad. People are not, the scientists are not the way they should be. They've lost that quest for truth. They've lost that aspiration, that sense of integrity, that eagerness for knowledge. So I said to him, very gently, because I didn't want to offend him, I said, a few minutes ago you were explaining that all the truth is there in the chemicals and in the electrical impulses. Now you're talking about integrity, aspiration, and truth. Those things are also chemicals and electrical impulses. He doesn't see it. He doesn't even aware that he's living in a contradiction, that his beliefs and his own feelings are diametrically opposite to one another. Well, probably when we most feel that we are sincere in our beliefs to Sri Aurobindo and we believe everything Appa has written, probably if we consult our feelings, we'll see that we are equally living in conflict with what we know to be true. To see that conflict and to overcome that conflict, that's not easy. Especially, I can tell you, but I'm sure, being an American where I grew up believing that the material things and the scientific things are all reality, when I have to remind myself it's not this tangible thing that I can touch and hold that really has the power, it's this vague, intangible, nebulous, evanescent feeling of sincerity or something that Dapa calls consecration. 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 If you want me to drink the bottle of water, I can do it. If you want me to consecrate, I'm not sure where it is, how it is, what it looks like. It seems to be so nebulous, and yet it's so powerful. How is it that something that seems not to exist at all, according to our senses, consecration has never been found in the anywhere. It's never been observed on any microscope or any telescope, or it's never been measured or weighed. It's never been analyzed, and yet it's so powerful. She took took a decision. I want to be mistress of Pemberley. He comes the next minute. What is a decision? Nobody has ever seen a decision. Even our own decisions we can't see. We take them, but we can't see them. We can't see the shape of them. We can only see the result of them. So the fundamental spiritual truth that which seems to be least existent, most illusory, is really most powerful. Our prayer, our faith, grace, is far more powerful than any material thing or any physical thing we can do, any act we can do. Our intention is much more powerful than any act. So the scientist takes one view, one extreme, and I call him an illusionist. We have talked in some of the earlier meetings about the placebo effect. According to the scientist has become so much a materialist today that he's trying to treat all psychological conditions as if they're also material conditions. And now, for any psychological condition, they're giving a drug. And it's very interesting. The result is, for depression, they're now treating depression not as a psychological condition, but as a physical condition. And the result is, the amount of depression is going up. The number of depressed people is increasing very, very high. I read an article last week, I wasn't able to believe it, in the United States, 23% of the students are taking antidepressant drugs. It used to be about 6%, and when I was not 1%. So the more we believe that everything is material, the more helpless we become. The more helpless we become to solve our own problems, because we're believing in an illusion. The doctor is faced day to day with evidence that the attitude of the patient is very powerful. I've narrated that story of Mr. Wright, who cured his own tumor just by changing his mind. I think some of you may remember, there are many examples of what they call the placebo effect. Every doctor who is sincere knows that the patient's attitude is more important than the treatment. And I think I mentioned recently that data shows that the placebo effect in America is getting more powerful. That is, giving a patient a piece of candy and telling him it's a very powerful drug is curing more and more people than ever before. And the doctors know this, and all the chemical companies know this. What does it tell them? What should it tell them? It should tell them that it's not the drug that's curing the patient, it's the belief in the drug that's curing the patient. But rather than change the practice of medicine to recognize this truth, they're giving more and more antidepressants. They're giving more and more drugs. So I'm not complaining about the scientists. I'm trying to hint that if we scratch the surface and examine our own behavior, we'll probably see we're doing the same thing. Even when we see the power of consecration, even when we see the power of prayer, we go and do the outside, we do the old thing, we rely on the old method, even when our experience is completely contradictory to that. Jalani told me once about a year ago, she was having trouble with her internet connection. And for 5 days, she was calling BSNL, trying to get this corrected. For 5 days, every day she's spending hours. She's not even able to get through on the line to the man at BSNL. They're not even picking up the phone. Finally, on the fifth or the sixth day, after she's dialed the number, suddenly she says, you know, I think I should consecrate. She just thought about consecrating this to Mother. Immediately, the man picked up the phone. And within 2 minutes, the problem was solved that had waited there for 5 days. Now, of course, anybody who's had that dramatic experience, the next time their internet connection is not working, of course, the first thing she would do is what? Call BSNL, right? That's the message. Our problem is not with the illusionist or with the scientist. Our only problem is to be sure we're not doing the same thing all the time. Because it's a human error. It's not to one person or another. Okay, so the scientist goes to one extreme. The illusionist goes to another extreme. And it's very interesting to see the similarity in their approach. That's what he brings out in this chapter. Spiritual experience is of many types and many ranges. And there are spiritual experiences that God is love, or God is truth, or God is power, or God is joy. God is an infinite existence or an infinite consciousness. God is something beyond any description. God is Purusha, Ishvara, Atman, Krishna. But the illusionist, the extreme form of illusionism, took the view that there's only one real spiritual experience, and that is the experience of the silent, immobile, immutable, infinite, eternal self. It's not a being. It's not a God. It has no form. It has no action. It's unrelated to the world. And the experience of the silent Brahman, the silent self, is a great spiritual experience. And Shankara built, the theory of illusionism was built on the truth of a great spiritual experience. But a truth that was converted into a philosophy by the mind. And the mind said, this bone is true, and everything else is not true. This alone is real, and everything else is not real. This alone exists, and the other things don't really exist. And now if you think about what the scientist is doing, you can see he's doing the same thing. This alone is true. Not your thoughts, not your feelings, not your aspirations, not your prayer, and not your consecration. This alone is true, and everything else is not real. So the dilemma for the illusionist was to explain everything else. The scientist wakes up, he has emotions, he feels anger, he feels happy, he feels love, he feels joy, he feels frightened, but he has to explain that. He has to explain it in terms of chemistry. But how is the illusionist going to explain what's going on all around him? He also wakes up in the morning, he gets hungry, he gets angry, he gets jealous, and all. He says, no, it just doesn't exist. It's only an imagination. Don't think about it. Put it away. The goal is to get out of the illusion as quickly as possible. Nothing that has form is real, because reality is formless. Nothing that moves is real, because the reality is static. Nothing that has any characteristics, nothing that is multiplicity is real. The reality is only the one. And this is the extreme form of illusionism. And in explaining that, you have to say, well, what about I am seeing the bottle. So what is real here? The bottle is not real. It's only an object. Objects are not real. No object is real. It's only Maya. Okay, but what about me? I'm seeing the bottle. I'm also not real. My thinking that I'm seeing a bottle, my thinking that I am, is also the illusion of Maya. But I'm seeing the bottle. What about my seeing? My act of perception is also not real. Neither the subject, me, nor the object, nor the act of perception are real. They are all Maya. There's no universe. There's only the Brahman. It's an interesting point of view. I would find it hard to believe, except the scientist is saying something very similar today in the opposite direction. And obviously, I think there are some problems with this view, as Shurabindo explains. First question is, if all of this is unreal and all of this is the creation of Maya, what is the reality of Maya? Maya is the creation of Brahman. Maya is the consciousness force of Brahman. But Maya seems to create only illusion. How can something that is the consciousness force of truth and reality create illusion? Well, the extreme version of illusionism says Maya itself is an illusion. Maya doesn't really exist. So Sri Aurobindo says, so if Maya is an illusion, and the world is an illusion, and the soul is an illusion, and our bondage is an illusion, then what about moksha? The illusionist says we should take all our efforts to get out of the illusion and get back to reality. But the illusion doesn't exist, and the soul doesn't exist. So that means moksha also doesn't exist, because it's all an illusion. This is the logic. When you take the extreme form of illusionism, it not only deprives us of any existence. It deprives life of any meaning. Because if this is an illusion, there can't be any value in getting out of it. If we are an illusion, it's like you can't make Darcy into a real character. He's only a character in the story. If Darcy decides that he wants to come out of the story, there's no way for him. He exists only in a story. He has no reality of his own. He's only part of the illusion. So it raises many questions. If Brahman is a reality, how can it create an unreal force of creation, Maya? And if Maya exists, and Maya is not Brahman, Brahman cannot be the sole reality. Because now you've got Brahman, who is the truth, and you've got a force of imagination or illusion, which is other than Brahman. And if Maya is from Brahman, how can truth create illusion? And what is the purpose of anything? These are some of the questions that he raises regarding the extreme version of illusionism. But he's not finished there. Because the version of illusionism that lasted for a long time, Shankara's version of illusionism, is what is called a qualified illusion. It's not this extreme form. Shankara has tried to reconcile these inconsistencies and these conflicts in a different way. In one of the Upanishad talks about Brahman is fourfold. There are four stages or states of being of the Brahman. One of them is the pure, undivided one that we know as Brahman. The self as a superconscient, undivided oneness. There's a second state which the Upanishad calls the sleep self. It's described as a luminous massed consciousness, a causal consciousness. It's the source of all creation. So he doesn't say at this point, my understanding is, Shrivindo's talking about, they were talking about the supermind. The supermind, if Brahman is Satchidananda, if that supreme self is Satchidananda, this is the sleep self, what they call the sleep self, the supermind. Then they have something called the dream self. This is the subtle or subliminal being. The subtle reality, all our thoughts belong to it, all emotion belongs to it, all that's not physical belongs to it. And then there is the waking state, which we're in. This description in the Upanishads was meant to describe the fact that reality takes four different forms or states. It is the superconscient one, it is the supermental creative consciousness, it is a subtle subliminal consciousness, and it is also the material world. But they use the words sleep and dream. So the illusionist caught on to this word sleep and dream and said, these states are not really real. Only that one is real. Only the one self is real. So they draw on the words of the Upanishad to support the illusionist doctrine. Sri Aurobindo has an aphorism in which he says that God laughed at Shankara three times. The first time was when he performed the rituals for his mother after she passed away. Because if really the world is an illusion, then death is an illusion, and the rituals are an illusion, and there cannot be any meaning in doing those things. The second was when he traveled all over India creating the mutts. Because if the life is an illusion, then creating a sect and a religious practice and a set of disciplines for illusory people living in an illusory world must also be an illusion. And the third was when he wrote a commentary on the Isha Upanishad, in which he explained his theory of illusionism. The Isha Upanishad is the one which says, all is Brahman. This boy is Brahman. That old man is Brahman. This tree is Brahman. That leaf and grass is Brahman. But he was able to write a commentary in which he ended up with the opposite conclusion that none of this exists, only that exists. This is the capacity of the mind. But Sri Aurobindo says there has never been a greater intellect than Shankara. So what does it tell us? It tells us the problem is not because somebody made a mistake in their philosophy. The problem is that he was using the instrument of mind to try to know reality and explain reality. And the reality cannot be known by the mind. And it doesn't matter who it is. If they're going to use the instrument of mind to know reality, they're going to end up either like the scientists denying their own emotions and convictions and ideals and values, or they'll end up like the illusionists denying their own physical experience and life because of the nature of mind. So the relevant thing for us, few of us are scientists, and I suspect fewer even are illusionists. The nature, the message of this chapter for us is to understand what is the nature of our mind and how it's creating illusions for us in our own lives. And how it's constantly dividing reality into what's real and unreal and giving us that illusion. This is the real message of the chapter. He says, very interesting, I don't think anyone's ever said it. There was a conflict in Shankara. He had a great spiritual realization of the One. I think we'd all be very happy to have that realization, to know that there's a silent, infinite, eternal oneness, which is pure bliss. But he also had a strongly developed mind, which told him that this is real, that this is, the world exists, that he exists, that perception exists, consciousness exists. So he was trying to reconcile a high spiritual experience with his senses and his own mental perceptions and his own thoughts. And so he came up with a qualified illusionism. And in his qualified illusionism, he didn't exactly say that this is unreal or it doesn't exist. It's an unreal reality. The real reality is the One, but this is a temporary real reality. Brahman has allowed itself to take the poise of Maya that we are in. So we think we are separate individuals. We think we are here in the physical body. We think that's real. But when we wake up, we'll find out it wasn't really real, or it's no longer real. And therefore, it's an unreal reality. It's a halfway reality. And he uses the analogy of the pot that's made of earth. And when the pot that's made of earth, when the pot is broken, put back, it returns to being mud, it no longer exists. So in his analogy, in Shankara's analogy, the pot, the earth is Brahman, the pot is you and me. We think we're real. Okay, we are real for a moment, but after we return to the earth, when the pot is broken and melts back to clay, we're no longer real. So the goal is to get to the clay. Sri Aurobindo says, but if the earth is real, then the pot made of the earth is also real. If the gold is real, then the jewelry or the tumbler or the vase or the bar or whatever it is made out of the gold is also real. And even if the jewelry is melted back again into pure gold, into a bar, it doesn't mean that the jewelry wasn't real. It only means the form has changed. It's come from a bar to a jewelry, and it's gone back from jewelry to a bar, but that doesn't mean it's any less real as jewelry or as a spoon or a vase as it is as a gold bar. It's real in any form it takes. It raises a fundamental question. If Brahman is the infinite, eternal, omnipotent reality, why can't Brahman take form? In the traditional illusionist theory, the extreme theory, Brahman is formless. I kind of imagine Brahman like Mr. Bennett in the library. He's the head of the household. He can do anything he wants as long as he remains in the library. That's the description of Brahman in the illusionist tradition. Brahman is incapable of taking form, not permitted to take form. The real reality is a formless, helpless reality. This is the conception on which illusionism is based. What is Sri Aurobindo's conception? The real reality is without any limit. Not only can't it be limited to any form, it can't be limited from taking any form. It can be anything and everything and still remain unlimited. And even if it becomes a whole universe, it's not limited by being a universe or by being a million universes. To the mind, the formless one, either the one must be real or the world must be real. To Sri Aurobindo, the one is the world. The one has become the world, and it doesn't cease to be one when it becomes the world any more than the gold ceases to be gold when it becomes a million different objects of gold. So, this problem is a philosophical problem that's caused by the mind, because we think something must be either that or this. We get lost in the contradictions. Either I have the power or life has the power. Which is it? Either I have the 100 crores or I don't have the 100 crores. Which is it? The truth is, you all have the 100 crores, you have the power of the 100 crores. You have to decide, like Lizzie, when she wants to be mistress of Pemberley, when the 100 crores to show up on the front doorstep. You have the 100 crores even when you don't see it. You have the power of it. Now, this is the time when no grace will come in May, no flower will come. So part of the problem was the illusionist tried to explain mentally something that can't be resolved mentally, because the mind knows things by division. It's either this or that. It contrasts things. The reality that we're talking about is not something that can be contrasted with anything else. There's nothing to contrast with Brahman. There's nothing outside of Brahman. There's nothing different than Brahman. There's nothing beyond Brahman. Therefore, any mental philosophy is going to get us into trouble. But there's another thing. Shankara had a great experience of the spiritual oneness. And he came to the conclusion that this was the ultimate spiritual experience. And compared to that, all other spiritual experiences were, let's say, unreal or less real. That the real, true experience of the reality of the Brahman was as the silent self. We can ask, how did he arrive at that conclusion? Because it was an overwhelmingly powerful experience. But Sri Aurobindo says, there are at least 100 different overwhelmingly powerful spiritual experiences that have equal conviction to them. The devotee who sees Krishna coming and embracing him, or the devotee who sees Mother uplifting and enfolding him, or the devotee who feels full of bhakta or full of ananda, or full of divine power, is having an overwhelming spiritual experience that defies any logic or qualification. So what has Shankara done? He's taken one experience and said, all others are inferior. This is the real experience. So, actually, if you read this chapter carefully, you'll find Sri Aurobindo is very humorous, but he has his own very subtle form of humor. He says, illusionism has unified reality by elimination. When we say, all right, let's come to an agreement on everything, and we'll unify ourselves into a single group, it's like my saying, all of you leave. If you all leave, I have come to a unification. Now it's harmonious. Now there's only one view. Illusionism unifies by sending everything away and rejecting it as non-existent, and there's only one thing left, so it's unified, it's one. Sri Aurobindo says, a real unification shouldn't exclude anything. A real unification shouldn't say, I'm right and you're all wrong. Or my experience alone is great and real and all your experiences are maya or illusion or secondary or subordinate. A real unification would discover the truth in every viewpoint. Would discover the truth in every spiritual experience. But it wouldn't be limited by any viewpoint or any spiritual experience. A real unification of pride and prejudice, the real knowledge of pride and prejudice is only there when we can explain to ourselves, how is it that Wickham got rewarded for all of these things he did? How can this, I understand why Lizzie became Mistress of Pemberley. I understand why Jane ended up with Bingley and all. But how did this scoundrel Wickham end up being a nephew, a cousin of Darcy or whatever, brother-in-law of Darcy? It doesn't make sense. He's done everything wrong. Is there any truth? Is there any possible view by which we can understand that there's a truth in Wickham? Life is rewarding him. So either life is an illusion. Are you an illusionist? No. Either life is an illusion, he's given something he totally doesn't deserve, or there must be a truth in his position. Certainly not the whole truth. We're not trying to make him an angel. He's a scoundrel. But there must be some truth in his position for him to be rewarded. Can we find that truth? That means in our worst enemy, in the person who's persecuted us, offended us, lied to us, treated us, mistreated us in every possible way, there must be some truth. And Sri Aurobindo says, there is a truth in every viewpoint. There's even a truth in every philosophy. The problem of every philosophy, whether it's the scientific philosophy or the illusionist philosophy, is when the illusionist or the scientist says, and what they both say is, I alone am right. And everybody else is wrong. Whereas the real truth has to see there's a truth in materialism, there's a truth in illusionism, there's a truth in the psychology, there's a truth in all, and how do they meet? How do we reconcile them? Well, Appa has reconciled the truths in Pride and Prejudice. He said, the real truth of Pride and Prejudice is the society is evolving. The society's trying to avoid social revolution. And that means the classes have to come together. To avoid the clash, people at all levels have to be brought together. Wickham is rewarded for two reasons that I can think of. There may be more. He's rewarded because he's an instrument for bringing Lizzie and Darcy together. He gives Darcy the opportunity to overcome his pride and prejudice. He's rewarded because he's an instrument for the evolution of Darcy. He may be lying. He may be mean and selfish. But there is a truth in his actions and the results of his actions, and he's rewarded for that. So if there's a truth in every viewpoint, like Mike, can you give him the mic? Yes. Yes, she was. Yes. And she was right. She ended up not being at odds with anybody. She ended up even. True. Because she took one view and denied the opposite. But even when we thought she's completely deluded in illusion, it turns out that she recognized there was a truth of Wickham. She said, I think they must both be right. She didn't know what his truth was. She refused to call him an evil man and reject him. He ends up being her brother-in-law. There was a truth in her position. There was a truth in Lady Catherine's position when she came and abused Lizzie. First of all, that's exactly what Darcy was thinking about the Bennet family. Not only that, this is exactly what Lizzie was thinking about her own family. There was nothing that Lady Catherine spoke that Lizzie didn't feel herself. That's not the whole truth. The fact of the matter is, Lizzie's family was very low in consciousness. And she could rise to the top only when she accepted that truth. And what Lady Catherine said to her reflected a truth. When she accepted that truth, she rose. What Lady Catherine refused to accept was the opposite truth, that though her family may be very low, Lizzie is very high in her consciousness. She's developed in her consciousness. She's an individual in her consciousness. She's more cultured and developed than Lady Catherine and Darcy's family. So what we do, like the scientist, like Lady Catherine, what we do is we see one part of the truth and we want to insist on it and eliminate everything else. It's unification by elimination. What is the whole truth? Everything that exists represents a truth. And our job is not to push away all of that and take this. Our job is to get to the truth that includes all the truths. And that is Sri Aurobindo. And that is what he's written in Life Divine. It's not a question of whether the materialist right and this bottle is real, or the illusionist right and the silent self is real. This is real, that's real, I am real, you're real, our perceptions are real, but they're all partial realities. The experience of the silent Brahman itself is a partial reality. Because if you experience that and think that alone is true, if you fail to realize that this is also Brahman, that this is also Brahman, that life and the world is Brahman, that 100 other spiritual experiences are Brahman, that the experience of the divine as God or goddess or power or love or joy are also real, then we are making the mistake of the scientist and the illusionist. When my neighbor is making noise or giving me trouble, or my landlord is trying to raise the rent, or my employer is harassing me, or my employee is harassing me, and I see only that they are wrong and I am right, I'm doing the same thing. I'm failing to realize and recognize the truth is, the reality is integral. The reality is something that transcends all of the parts and all of the viewpoints and all of the pieces. Why does this matter to us? Because until we get to the reality, we're going to be helpless. The scientist is going to be helpless when his child becomes depressed because he's insisting on a limited truth as if it's everything. The illusionist is going to be helpless when he breaks his toe on the stone, because he's focused on one thing and denying the rest. Darcy's going to be helpless as long as he thinks everybody's a savage. And the same is true of Lady Catherine. But when we can accept that everything around us, inside and everything, outside, every outer circumstance reflects a truth, every inner feeling reflects the truth, and everything, every spiritual experience reflects the truth, we have to move from believing in one to getting to that which is the source of all of them. And that is what Sri Aurobindo's asked us to do, and the method he's given for that is consecration. He says, whatever happens, what Mother says is, whatever you want, whatever happens, the first thing we should do is consecrate it. What does that mean? It means don't rely on the outer thing. Don't even rely on the inner thing. Rely on that which is the truth of everything. The consecration is to the inner divine. That inner divine is not different from the divine up there. Is not different from the divine out there. There's only one divine. And that divine includes all. In synthesis of yoga, in the chapter on self-consecration, he describes the experience that the seeker has of discovering the divine within himself, that he is the divine, not just that he has an immortal soul, but that the immortal soul is an expression of the divine. But he doesn't stop there. He must also discover that everyone around him has that immortal soul. And everyone around him is also the divine. And everything around him is also the divine. Every form, every object, every being. And third, he must know that that immortal divine in him is also beyond the universe. It's also beyond all form and all characteristic of any type. It is transcendent to the universe. Now, any great soul who has had one of these experiences, Shankara talks about discovering the transcendent. In the Gita, they talk about discovering the inner divine, the divine inside. In cosmic consciousness, they talk about seeing the world as divine. Any one of these realizations is a great realization. Sri Aurobindo says, the three of them together, he calls it the first fundamental city of the integral yoga. Meaning, until you know all three of these as one, until you know that yourself and the world and the transcendent are one, you have not really begun this yoga. This is the first step. This is the entrance exam. Because he's trying to reunify the individual, the universe, and the transcendent, because they are all one. Practically for us, it means we must try to reunify our innermost experience the world around us with our highest conception and faith in Mother and in Grace. When we can accept that, when we can try to live from that center, imagine Mother living in your heart. Offer everything inside to her, offer everything outside to her, offer highest aspirations to her. Make that the center of unification for everything. The scientist in the lab, he's doing physical experiments. When he goes home, he quarrels with his wife or he cries with his child. He lives in two separate worlds. This is unrelated with that. We also do the same thing very often. We pray with greatest devotion in the center, and then we go out and quarrel with the auto driver or when we're buying the fruits in the marketplace or with our own family members like that. We have to reintegrate. Why do we live in this divided, splintered existence? Because we live in mind and ego. Why is that a problem? Because we think that we're separate. Each of us thinks we are separate from the world around us. See, if you had my problems, then you would appreciate how difficult it is. We all think, you have to see my point of view, right? Everybody should see my point of view. Because I'm separate from everybody else. Until we come out of that feeling that we are separate, until we come out of that division which mind has created, we're going to be in the illusion. We're going to be in the ignorance. We're going to be subject to all types of misconceptions and confusions of all the everything the characters do in the story, everything the scientist does and the illusionist does. The advantage we have is he has told us the secret. He has told us the reality, and he's given us a way, and he's given us a method. Mother, the name of Mother is a mantra for unification. It's a mantra to heal all of the division. Okay, we call Mother, we think of her for a minute, and we overcome the division. It's like Darcy coming. She thinks I could be Mistress of Pemberley. All the problems are over the next minute. And then immediately we go back and call BSNL the next time around. We come out of the unity, we go back to the division. Everything that happens to us happens to try to take us to that unification. Not the unification by elimination, by getting rid of all of the people who are wrong, but the unification that discovers the truth in everything and everybody. And when we do that, we find out, how can I unify with my problems? How can I unify with all those difficult people? What we discover is, the more we try to unify, the problems disappear. The troublesome people either become positive people or they go away, because the only thing that was making them troublesome was that we were treating them as separate. We were dividing ourselves from the reality. The only thing we need to change is not how to get rid of that person or that thing, but how to get rid of that false consciousness in ourselves that divides and separates us from the reality. So what does Sri Aurobindo say? Yes. Yes, very good. Excellent. Excellent. And she doesn't know how so what created the miracle? Her belief. She believed the problem was with the child. She shifted her reliance from the child to the inner truth. And Appa says, everything that we perceive as a problem, everything without exception, is really an opportunity. No exception. Every problem that comes to us, rather, it's not that it's a problem. It's that we perceive it as a problem. We perceive it as a problem because we are in a false consciousness. When we change our consciousness, the problem becomes an opportunity. The child's dyslexia or whatever it was not a problem. It was an opportunity for her to discover the inner power she had. It's not that the problem disappeared. The problem was the opportunity all along. The problem was an opportunity for her to awaken in consciousness to the real power she has for the sun's blossoming and growth. As long as she thinks the problem is with the sun, she misses the point. The power is with her. All along, the power was with Lizzie. She kept saying, "You're the last man on earth. I don't want you. I won't dance with you. I don't want this. I don't want that." The whole thing came so she should discover the power in her. We are all happy when we solve a problem. Oh, yes, Mother is great. She helped me solve the problem. But that's not really realizing the truth. There was never a problem. There was only an opportunity which we refuse to see unless it comes to us in the form of a problem. And every problem that we've solved was really an opportunity to discover the truth, more of the truth about ourselves and the power we have. And the valuable thing is not that the problem was solved. The valuable thing is the knowledge we should acquire about the power we have. That's a common theme in Appa. He says every time we solve a problem, we forget how we did it and we only focus on the result. The real value of it is not the result. The real value of it is the process, the power that we have. It's a wonderful, wonderful example. So what is the reality of Maya? What is the truth of Maya? What is the truth of the world? He says, the truth of Maya is, it is the power of the infinite to take form. It is the power of the infinite to manifest itself. And what Maya manifests are truths of itself. And the world is a truth of it, and the individuals are truths of it. But there is only one reality. It is Brahman. But that Brahman has become the world or many worlds. Yet, when we look at the world, it doesn't look very Brahmic. It doesn't look very true. So there's some problem with this logic. It's too simple. It's too easy. Instead of being an illusionist that says everything is false, we end up being a starry-eyed optimist that says everything is divine. But everything doesn't look divine or feel divine or act divine. So there's some truth that the illusionists have perceived. There is a truth in the illusionism. And our job is not to reject the illusionist. Our job is to discover what is true in the illusionism. Because there's a truth in every view. And the truth that the illusionist discovered is the world as we see it is certainly, if not an illusion, it's a gross distortion of reality. If the divine is infinite existence, consciousness, and bliss, certainly the world we know doesn't qualify, it doesn't look that way, doesn't feel that way, doesn't act that way. How do we reconcile these truths, if these reality? If we're not going to reconcile it by saying the world is an illusion and that alone is true, there must be another explanation. And that's why he wrote this book. He says, the world is not non-existent. The world is a creation of Brahman. The world is a manifestation of Brahman. But the way we experience the world is not in its truth. We experience it in the ignorance. The problem is not with the world. The problem is with our perception of the world, because we are in the ignorance. The problem is not a cosmic illusion. The problem is a cosmic ignorance. Well, what's the difference between calling the world an illusion and calling it an ignorance? Aren't we just splitting hairs? He says, no, there's all the difference in the world. Because this world and each of us is the divine truth hidden and in the process of evolving and revealing itself. We are the divine, ignorant of our true nature, living in an ignorant, limited, false consciousness. But the reality, our consciousness is false, but our existence is true, is real. It's not a false existence, it's a false consciousness. It's not an unreal being, it's an unreal view. What we have to do is not throw away the being, we have to throw away the view, which is our ignorance. We have to know that the way we are experiencing reality is false, is ignorant. And when we do that, what happens? As we awaken to the truth in our consciousness, we discover the world is not only real, but it's divine. The world need not change. Our consciousness of the world needs to change. And consciousness in the world is evolving. We started out involved in matter. The world started out as a material inconscient, and the divine is evolving to life and evolving to human life and is going to evolve to divine life, because even in matter, even in the inconscient, it is the divine that's hidden there. It is the divine that has involved itself there and is evolving. So the ultimate goal is not to get out of this universe. It's to get out of the false consciousness of this universe so that the life of falsehood, ignorance, and error can become the divine life. It's not a unification by elimination, it's a unification by moving from the ignorance to the knowledge. And in this book, part two is about the knowledge. Part two, book two, part one is about the knowledge and the ignorance. Actually, book two is the knowledge and the ignorance, spiritual evolution. And in this part, we're now in book two, part one, the whole 14 chapters is talking about the nature of the ignorant. And the reason he wrote these two chapters was to tell us ignorance is not illusion. Be clear about it. The ignorance is not that the world is totally non-existent. Our view of the world is ignorant. The thing we have to change is not go to some other world. We have to change our view. We have to evolve in consciousness. It's an evolution of consciousness. The being, there's nothing wrong with the being. The being of the world is Brahman. There's nothing wrong with your being or my being. Our being is a divine soul. We need not change it for some other being. In our being, in our pure existence, we are already divine. Our problem is in our consciousness. And as you're going to hear on the first, he has a famous line, as is the consciousness, so is the force. Whatever is our consciousness, the forms around us, the life around us, manifest that consciousness. We need not change the world. When we change our consciousness, everything around us, every form, every behavior, everything will change in proportion. The power is with us. So it's not to escape, it's to evolve. There's a huge difference because it's telling us our destiny is here. Our destiny is in the world. Our destiny is not to get to something other than ourselves. We are already in our being, the thing we should be, we're divine. But our consciousness is not divine. We're in a false, divided, mental, egoistic consciousness. And when we get to the right consciousness, we will see the world is divine and life is divine. And then he ends with a very important argument that until this chapter, I have completely missed it in the book. Because when I think of evolution, I've always thought, divine is up there, I'm down here, evolution is from below to above. No? I'm matter, he's spirit, or mother is spirit, and I have to get from here to there, which is not very similar. Not very different than what Shankara said. This is all the falsehood, that's all the truth, you have to get from here to there. That's not what he said. That's not at all what he said. He said, the creation of the universe is by a double involution. When the divine becomes the universe, it creates two involutions. One of them we call the inconscient, in which the spirit is hidden in the form, and the other we call the superconscient, in which the form disappears, the force disappears, the consciousness disappears, and there's only pure being. And the problem, whether we are the ascetic who's going to the superconscient or the materialist who's insisting on the inconscient is, we see that alone as real. To the scientist, matter is the reality. To the illusionist, the pure being is the reality and nothing else is the reality. And all along, he's been trying to tell us in every chapter, maybe almost in every paragraph, the reality is the being, the consciousness, and the force. The pure self, the pure matter, and everything in between. The reality is the includes all. The absolute is not some vacant something up there. Spirit is not there. It is there. It's also here. In two extreme forms, and both the materialist and the ascetic go after the extreme form by a process of eliminating everything else. And he says the destiny is not to eliminate, but to unify. And the evolution is a double evolution. It is the spirit awakening from the form below. It is the spirit emerging from the superconscient into the world from above. And where they unite, inconscient and superconscient become conscious, become the conscious. And who do they become the conscious in? Us. We the individual, who the illusionist wants to say is a non-existing, irrelevant fact. We give it up as quickly as possible. It's a disease. And the scientist says it's an illusion, there's no individuality, there's only chemistry and electricity. We are the key to the whole mystery, because the infinite divine is evolving in our consciousness. It is in us that the consciousness evolving from below and the consciousness descending from above meet. Each time I call BSNL, I'm reinforcing my inconscience. Each time I consecrate, I'm calling the consciousness from above. And like most of us, I'm mostly insisting on where I came from and not where I'm going. We are the point of unification in our consciousness. That is the destiny of the individual. That's why we're so important. The whole universe is evolving in us. To put it differently, the divine is evolving in us. The divine needs us. How can the divine need us? We are the divine. The divine doesn't need us. The divine is us. The divine has become us. Why? Because it wants to manifest in the universe. It wants to manifest infinitely, in infinite variety. It wants the delight of an instant, infinite interaction with itself, because there's nobody else to interact with. And each of us is that infinite opportunity to everybody around us. Not to dominate over them, and like Mrs. Bennett wants to do, and steal a march over everybody. Each of us is there to help awaken the divinity in each other. So the idea that spirit is above, matter is below, and we have to get from here to there, we are all illusionists. We've not understood. As long as we think that way, we're thinking the same way as 2,000 years ago. We have to understand this moment, right here, in the body, in this moment, when we're thinking, feeling, sensing, calling Mother, remembering her, consecrating, we are the divine in the process of evolution, in the evolution of consciousness that's going to make life divine. We're not just an ordinary actor in this, or a prop in the divine's play. We're the key actor. We have to make it happen. That's the opportunity we have. And that's every moment, and every problem is presented to us for that purpose. So, illusion is true. But it's not an illusion of unreality. It's not of unreal being. It's an illusion of consciousness, which we better, to avoid further confusion, we have enough already. He calls it ignorance. Our problem is not illusion, it's ignorance. Our problem is with our consciousness, not with our being. And when we get out of that illusion, when we get to the true consciousness that matches the truth of our being, we discover the truth of the Gita, that we can become whatever we believe we can become, or whatever we want to become. Because it's not me, it's not you or I, it is the divine which wants to manifest itself in us. And the act of consecration is the act of saying, instead of my will, I want this, the act of consecration is to say, thy will be done in me. Thy will, not my will. Meaning, let me be what you want me to become. It would be more accurate to say, let me be what you want to become, because the real me, the real you, is the divine in you that wants to manifest, the soul in you, not the ego, not the separate person. But the divine in you wants to manifest in you, but we have to get out of the way and let that happen. So when that happens, we don't discover the reality. We create the reality. We create the world we want to be in, because all the time the power has been there in us. Can we have any questions? Anybody have a question or a comment or an anecdote or experience? Lizzie had an unconscious experience. She thought of being the mistress of Pemberley, and he came. Being a Westerner, she never would have connected the two events. She would have never realized that the moment she changed her attitude, he came. Because we're not educated that way. We're ignorant. We're stupid materialists. We don't see any connection between the outside and the inside. But every devotee has seen, not once, but so many times, that when we changed an attitude, or voiced a prayer, or consecrated, or had the sincerity, which there have been endless, countless examples we've heard, the life outside has changed. So we each have had the experience of the truth of this chapter. We each have had the experience many times of getting to that point of consciousness where for one moment we're in a consciousness of truth. And that one moment of truth is enough to make a problem vanish and convert into an opportunity, like it did for that woman and her son. What more do we need? Then everything that we consider a problem today is a very happy reminder to us, pointing us in a direction, reminding us to move from where we are to a consciousness of truth. So when I read this chapter, when you think about this chapter, think about it in terms of your own experience. Think about it in terms of the truth, the deepest truth of your own experiences. When you have seen life respond, you have seen Mother answer a prayer, you have seen your aspiration answered, at that point you were the closest to the truth of the universe, which the scientist definitely doesn't understand, and the illusionist is completely missed, because they both discarded this. Mother, Shurabindo, and Appa have brought us to the key truth in our own life, the formula that can take us forward. We need only be true to that and not go back and call BSNL the next time around. Anyone like to, any question, any comment? Some experiences share. Yes. So, as Vijaya has recalled one of the many experiences she's had, what each of us should do is go back to that experience of ours which is the most real, where we have discovered, seen that relationship between the inner and the outer. Start from there. Make that the sacred ground. Make that the territory where we live. Make that the magic circle with which we position ourselves. And live from that deepest, that's the deepest truth of our consciousness which we have seen. We may not have known how it happened. She doesn't know how. Vijay doesn't know how Appa thought at that moment and sent that word. Lizzie doesn't know how Darcy came at that moment. Make that deepest experience of yours the point from which you act, the point from which you consecrate, the faith from which you live, and reinforce it by constantly going back to it. Then we get the central message of this book. Central message of this book is not a philosophy. It's not a story of the supramental plane. The central message of this book is written to us. He's trying to awaken us to the truth of our being, to the truth of our consciousness, to the truth of our destiny, so we can take the next step. It's a personal message to each of us. And he ends this chapter. I don't know that he says it anywhere else in the book, I'm not sure. But in describing his ultimate conception of the divine in its evolution. It's interesting he does it in the chapter on illusion. Because illusion is the concealment within which the truth has to come out. And he talks in the last few pages of this chapter, I think it's 378, about what he calls the Supreme Ishwara. And in the Supreme Ishwara, he says, when you go beyond all the limiting experiences, all the limiting, wonderful, magnificent, hundred spiritual experiences, some of the power of the divine, some of the pure, infinite being of the divine, you come to a point in which the being of the divine, the consciousness of the divine, and the force of the divine are indistinguishable from one another. There's no separation between the unmanifest and the manifest. There's no separation between matter and spirit. There's no separation between the being and the form. There's only the divine, but it's not a vacant, empty, formless divine. It's a divine that fills all form and goes beyond all form in the universe. And the one in the many in the one, it is really everything is divine, and that divine is a being, is a conscious being, in which all power is there to instantly become anything it wants to become. That is our destiny, individually. It's not a one. Each soul's destiny is to become the Supreme Ishvara, something to look forward to. You understand.
Gary sir ஓட ஸ்பீச்ல எப்படி அதை ரீயூனிஃபை பண்ணிட்டார் ஸ்பிரிட் அண்ட் நம்ம ஸ்பிரிட் அண்ட் மேட்டர்ங்கிறது செப்பரேட் இல்ல, இல்யூஷன் ஸ்பிரிட், அந்த ஸ்பிரிட்டை இதை சேர்த்து கொடுத்துட்டார். இனிமே நாம வந்து ஒர்க் பண்ற வேலை தான் அதுல, அதை ரெண்டையும் சேர்த்து எப்படி கொண்டு வந்தா நம்ம அதை தான் செய்யணும் இருக்கோம், அதை தான் அப்பா எழுதி தந்துட்டு இருக்காரு, அதை நம்ம சேர்க்கிற வேலை. இதுல பார்த்தானா ஒவ்வொரு சாப்டரும் எப்படி நம்ம இதுவரை பார்த்த சாப்டர்ஸ் எல்லாம் எப்படி கனெக்டடா ஃபைனலா இதுல நிக்கிறது. அதனாலதான் அவர் எங்கிட்ட பேசிட்டு இருக்கிறத சொன்னாரு, இந்த கான்சியஸ் ஃபோர்ஸ்ங்கிற சாப்டர் இப்ப பேசுறது இதுல உனக்கு ரெலவன்சி உனக்கு தெரியும் சொன்னார். அது உண்மை. அதாவது நம்ம மேன் இன் தி யூனிவர்ஸ், அப்புறம் இண்டிவிஜுவாலிட்டி, இதெல்லாம் நம்ம பார்த்துட்டே வரோம். ஆனா இதெல்லாம் சேர்ந்து ஒரு கம்ப்ளீட்டா ஒரு இதை நம்மளுக்கு இன்னைக்கு அவர் வந்து டெலிவர் பண்ணியிருக்கார். ரொம்ப சந்தோஷமான ஒரு அட்மாஸ்பியர். அன்னை அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் நன்றி கூறுகிறேன். முதலாவதாக மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்களுக்கு ஸ்பெஷலாக எல்லா தியானமய அன்பர்கள் சார்பிலும் நன்றி கூறி விடைபெறுகிறோம்.